So, Volodymyr Yanushek, we've met on many occasions at various biennales, international exhibitions, and I've met you by pure accident here in this little restaurant off the beaten track in Venice. So, give me some impressions. When did you arrive? You've seen the first 3 days.
Well, of course, I made the very intelligent decision to not arrive here on the Wednesday, which was the first day of the press views. One of the few advantages of being old enough to remember a lot of biennales is that you know you want to avoid the first day. I mean, talk about a feeding frenzy. It's a horrible event, I think. And it's just, I find, rather distressing to watch so many people trying to push into such a small space for what I think are the wrong reasons, really. I mean, one of the problems with all these events nowadays, and I think it's particularly true of Venice because the Biennale is such a not only a memorable event, but also one that everybody wants to come to. One of the problems with it is that it seems to me that it's not about art anymore. You know, it's about queuing up, it's about getting free tickets, it's about going to the right parties, it's about wearing the right clothes. To me, it's always amusing to see people whom I know well from London, who in London wear these sort of drab grey suits and go around looking miserable. They come to Venice and immediately they splash out on a big Panama hat and a navy blue blazer, and they've been watching too many Merchant Ivory movies, and they swan around town, you know, drinking their Bellinis, trying to look cosmopolitan. And they're more interested, I think, in trying to look cosmopolitan than they are in looking at the art. The great thing about Venice as a place, of course, is that art looks better here than it looks anywhere else. I mean, the framing, the ambience is magnificent.
It's been going now for over 100 years as an event, and we know it's got a particular structure to do with national pavilions. Is that getting a little shaky, do you think? I mean, is that something that really should be looked at in terms of a way of organising an international exhibition around those ideas of specific nationality?
To be honest, I think the word organisation and the words Venice Biennale don't really go together very well. I mean, of course, it always happens, which is an amazing achievement in its own right. But the thing never looks as if it's really been controlled from start to finish. There's always a haphazard and accidental feel to it. And I think that's a good thing, because, you know, you can always predict what a documenter's going to be once you've read one of the press releases put out by the organisers. But you can never predict what's going to happen at the Venice Biennale. It is an immensely unpredictable event, and I like that. And one of the reasons for that is because you've got this system of however many national pavilions. Each one's up to its own tricks. Each one makes its own decisions about what it's going to show. And in a way, you know, one of the problems with art today is that there's a kind of international consensus about what's in and what's out, what's groovy and what isn't. Everybody reads the same magazines. The same artists are hot at the same time. The same artists are out at the same time. And there is this sense in which you can go to a lot of exhibitions and see the same people. But at Venice, that's circumvented a little bit by the fact that these national pavilions, frankly, don't give a damn about what's written about in Flash Art the next week. They make their own decisions. And you can see some very interesting things and come across some very unexpected sights. And certainly see art trends that you wouldn't notice otherwise. And that, to me, is a good thing. It's probably the best reason for coming here. It's always full of energy, this show. It's very rarely full of great art, but it's almost always full of energy. And I like that, because I do actually find it very invigorating.
Do you think something, though, that's happened, and I think you've talked about this whole milieu of people that come at the very beginning, and sometimes you wonder what the event's about, and whether it's about art. I mean, art is becoming increasingly the news. I mean, maybe not so much in England, but, I mean, we've had Sherry Blair here, we've had Chris Smith here, we had Lady Di a few years ago, and it just seems to be becoming much more, you know, in the front, in the foreground in terms of culture. And that's a certain shift that's happened over recent years, isn't it?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. Art has become groovy, and it's in now in ways that it wasn't before. And all these international events help to cement that impression. I was thinking about this the other day. I was lying awake at night in London the other day trying to work out why the hell I was making this big trek to Venice in a week's time. You know, I know what's going to happen. I'm going to get barged out of the way by bigger Germans than me. You know, I'm going to have trouble getting the catalogues. I'm going to be pushed about. It's going to be a nightmare in many ways trying to get a seat to eat anywhere for lunch, etc., etc. But still, I want to come. And I think the reason is that art has one great talent. It has many great talents. There's one that's pertinent in this situation, which is it creates something out of nothing. out of nothing, you can make an event, you can make a something. And Venice, of course, is full of art from the past, and so there's many reasons to come here anyway. But the Biennale is a kind of separate reason for coming. And it's a tribute, in a way, to the power of art to lure people from around the world, to give them a focus, to give them a centre. And it's a great pleasure, really, isn't it? I mean, bumping into all these Australians and these Koreans, and this year in particular, all these Chinese. I mean, you know, fancy coming to Venice and meeting all these Chinese artists. But that's good for us, I think. I mean, we sit there in London, we read our copies of Flash Art Art in America. We think it all happens in New York or in London. But it's a very welcome development, I think, to see it broader than that. You go into the main Italian pavilion where they have their vague theme show, and the whole centre is occupied by Chinese artists. They play very big as well in the Aperto exhibition. Now, I don't think there has been an exhibition in London yet that could properly be called any kind of important exhibition of Chinese contemporary art. It hasn't happened. There have been a couple of things at the Marlborough. There have been a few shows of social realist stuff, but nothing about what's really happening in China at the moment. So you have to come to Venice to find out. And it's a bit of a blunt instrument, this, in that you're being banged over the head with these Chinese artists, and someone is clearly saying, look at China, it's going to be important. Their aesthetics are important, they're different. Look at it, take note of this. It's not all about New York and London. And there's that agitprop air to it almost. But to me, that's a valuable thing, and I actually welcome the experience. I don't necessarily like all the art, but I'm pleased to be able to make my own mind up about it.
This year, Harold Zeman seems to have kind of opened up a number of other spaces in Venice, in the Arsenali, the former naval yards, well, some of them still are naval yards. How do you think that's worked in terms of these new spaces that he's appropriated for this exhibition?
Venice has a tradition of seeping out of the Giardini and occupying funny little spaces around the town. I mean, we've all been to these curious old salt cellars and places where they made anchors or whatever they were, things that involve a bit of a journey to another experience. Personally, I really like that about it. In fact, there should be more of it. And anything that breaks us or takes us further away from the main Giardini, personally, I welcome that. And but these are magnificent spaces. I mean, the Arsenale is such a wonderful place to show art. Some of the old salt cellars where, you know, the Aperto is. They're wonderful places to show art. There's a Caro exhibition, which I don't like at all here, but it isn't a wonderful venue. It's an old industrial nautical space with all that atmospheric Venetian history attached to it. I mean, artists would kill to show in places like that. So it's got to be a good thing. And it does mean, of course, that the official story being told in the Giardini by the Biennale organisers has some hope of being broken down by a kind of fringe. There's always been a fringe here, but in my view, it's never been quite powerful enough. And there's still room for it to become an even more effective forum for art. As in all these kind of events, as in Edinburgh, as in Cannes, really, if you're looking to find out a little bit more and trying to find some things that are perhaps more exciting, less predictable, then you go off-site, don't you? There isn't quite enough of it here yet, but there will be. And it's obviously a growing trend. This Biennale is essentially a 20th century beast, and we're at the cusp of the 21st century. I mean, I have no doubt at all, and just from the things that happened to me this week, being pushed aside by 6'5" hulking Germans, being prodded in the ribs by Italian policemen, all that kind of stuff, all that is evidence of the growing stature of this Biennale, and it's going to be even bigger, isn't it, in the 21st century. If you think it's noisy now, if you think it's difficult to get a seat in a restaurant now, if you think it's hard to sleep at night here now, just wait 10 years from now, once even more people wake up to not only the beauty of Venice, which is here intrinsically, but also the excitement of some of the things that you can see at the Biennale. It's a massive event waiting to happen. It's going to be bigger than this.
Every year it grows in those terms, doesn't it? I mean, it's a very robust beast, and far from being an anachronism and something that is seeping away at the edges, it just seems to be becoming more and more authoritative.
It's a perfect fusion of a great venue and a fine idea. I mean, frankly, you could show up an envelope, couldn't you, in Venice, and it would look interesting, providing you've got the background of the city to it. It is a wonderful place to see art. You've got no cars, you know, there are wonderful vistas. Every time you step out on a jetty, there's something wonderful in the distance. The skies are magnificent. Sense of being different, of being somewhere other than you'd normally be, is so powerful here. And there is no other city like Venice. And all that is a great addition, I think, to the art. And the art itself, providing that it does remain, I think, reasonably haphazard, the selection of it, providing there is always room for things that no one's expecting to see, I mean, that, there's a lot of growth potential there. So I can only see it getting bigger. I can't necessarily see it getting better, but I can only see it getting bigger.
So now en route back to the Giardini, met Jan Hoot. Jan, do you have any particular views on the 1999 Venice Biennale in terms of its characteristics and its themes?
I think we have to divide in two parts. It's first the Giardini, and then there is the Arsenale. And then the third is all these first projects in the city, dialectics and all these things behind. But I'm a little bit disappointed about the pavilions. That's a little bit disappointing. I think it's not as strong as what we had before. For example, or it is too aesthetic, or it is a little bit too light. But nevertheless, there are some points which have my particular interest. For example, the Poland. I like very much the Bauhaus with the man, a woman artist, and very precise, very deep, going into the skill behind. For example, Anne Hamilton is more on the surface. Charming. But I miss a body there. The visitor also disappears. So I prefer the Pavilion of Belgium, because with Michel Francois, with the smoke, and but with the objects inside. So from time to time it's vague, but then you have a focus on things. You feel a physical touch. There's a tactility. The pavilion, the central pavilion, is not as good. It's a strange mixture of things which I have difficulties towards the correspondences and the associations and the connections. I don't know exactly why. You see, Dieter Roth, for example, it's not a work he did himself. It's an amalgam of things he did, but it's not a real show. Some pieces are very well, but then the Arsenale. I think the Arsenale is interesting because it's open, really open to Asia, to China, and the Chinese have a particular ability to deal with the clichés we all know in the development of contemporary art, a kind of irony also, and to project the academic style of China into this contemporary experiences and experiments as a kaif side with these sculptures made by fantastic arts and crafts people from China, which have all lost in our academies. But he plays with it. That's fantastic. He plays with it. He is master of it. It's not the man who is making it. It's the man who is conceive it. And that's, I think, a beautiful bridge between China and the Western world. Then there are some beautiful works as Dieter Appelt, Bruce Nauman, of course. There's also the mystical work from the man who prays, Mauricio Catalan. But generally, I have to say, we are in the time of chaos. Everything is based on chaos today, where we all have to deal with internet. And internet is the perfect catalyst of chaos. There is no censorship, there is no control, there is no system, the total chaos. And I think it's interesting, this. Nevertheless, there are some artists who are going too far, so there are no limits anymore. Before, we all criticized the curator of the show. And now the curator is taking distance, and he gives the space to the artist is taking over the power of the curator. And then it's lost. That's very strange.
Right, you really think that has happened in this Biennale?
In some time, yeah, with Jason Rhodes, for example.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. Jason Rhodes is so powerful, but so megalomaniac that you don't think on anymore on the curator. You think on the artist, right. And McCarthy and Hirshhorn. It's too much.
So it's not curated out of existence. The art is at the front, you think?
Yeah, I think the artist is in the front. But he lost control.
Right. That, I mean, that's a very interesting perception. Is that a, do you think, a general characteristic that the artist is central and in control? Because yeah. There are many other shows where they do look very curated, and there is a tendency increasingly for shows to be about curatorship.
Yes, in the way that before the curator was always choosing the work before. He was choosing the work and installing it.
Yeah.
Operating as a conductor. But today, it's only playing as the medium and to give the possibility to create. So the artist is taking it,
right.
Is claiming. Yes. It goes out of control, you understand? But this, I like it.
Right.
But sometimes it's too aesthetic. It's an aesthetic chaos.
But this would
aesthetic
suggest...
chaos.
This would suggest...
And I would prefer real chaos, not an aesthetic chaos.
But that model would suggest a certain redundancy for the curator, then, if the artist takes...
I think so, yeah. We don't speak anymore about Zeman. And then also because of the respect we have for him, as a man who is the godfather of the exhibition maker... We don't attack him. I think he was generous. His generosity has been so big that many artists were out of control. To be selected by such a man as Iman, they really did it carefully.
So you what see? He's done is provide space for artists to function within.
That's what I think. Great sense of trust and confidence and faith.
That's seeping through, I certainly think. But on the other hand, you have this traditional model of the Biennale, of the pavilions, where they're chosen by almost diplomatic curators
that's
in their own
sometimes.
Countries.
That's sometimes terrible, you know.
Yeah.
Some pavilions are really not good, you know. It's so sad to see that. Zeman, as a curator, should also have control on the people who have to do it, I think, and not only on the artists.
In a way, that's difficult, isn't it?
Because that's very difficult, because the nationalism...
National pavilions are owned by their countries.
Today there is an ambiguity between nationalism and local. Some people think that because of the country, it has to be nationalistic, and that's wrong. The nationalism should be used as a location from where everything is looking for an appeal to universal.
As we travel toward the gardens now in the lagoon... We just happen to have someone standing next to us who have some opinions.
Maybe one opinion. I thought that there was at least three pavilions who were all of a sudden like playing on another dimension, not on the intellectual lecture, but on the physical sensations. This was the American pavilion, the Belgian pavilion, and the German one. They were all like...
But also, Poland. Like, Poland.
Yeah. Exactly, but it's not anymore the lecture of the head, it's the lecture of the whole body, and this for me was new.
That's good, yeah.
Yeah? Don't you think so? And I said in the Arsenale there was a problem that you have too many artists who really lost control about what is tradition and what is knowing about at least what were happening 20 years ago. I mean, if you look to a piece like Pippi Lotti-Rist,
for example,
I mean, she just forgot completely what Beuys did with this little Fumo.
Yeah,
there are too many quotations, and it's sometimes you don't really know if they know that they are quoting.
Yeah, that's good.
I mean, do you think this model of a Biennale, which is structured around national pavilions, is that something now that really needs to be rethought, or is it working in this sort of strange, chaotic context that Jan's just been talking about?
I think the exhibition of Jan Hoots is just a good example how you can resolve a little bit the problem. Like Panama Renko, for example, who is a well-known artist, and Jan Hood just took a piece which is not so well-known.
Not
well-known. And
this is
fantastic. Very small, very tiny.
So you know each other,
yeah, sure.
You know each other, right?
Yeah, I'm a critic. Yeah. And so it's Doris van Draden. And I thought this is fantastic to do. This is a brilliant idea of Hervé Kreuz, for example, to have a piece which is a little bit outside... But of a great artist.
Yeah, and, you may have big things.
And it should be a real universal message. I think if you're, again, this little piece of Panama Renko is just such a good example. Because you might immediately, I'm a German critic. I'm not living in Germany, but I'm living in Paris. But immediately there are coming things to your head, that, like this little song of My Käfer Flieg. And you have all the thing, all the story of the war. And all the tragedy in this very little piece.
Yeah,
and I mean, this is fantastic, you know? And this is what is lacking, and I think there's so much design going around. There are pavilions, I won't quote them now, but there are pavilions which are like looking like new fashion magazines, you know,
like a nice boutique.
It's such a void and such an aura, but I mean, aura is not all.
Or yeah. Berkeley Hotel,
yeah.
As England, for example, with yeah. David Hume.
Yeah.
It has an hotel.
Yeah.
A fantastic, rich hotel.
Yeah. We really need to go out, what you said too, out of aesthetical categories by writing too. I mean, I'm always writing my hands off and trying to show that artists are not interested in art, but in life.
In life, true. And not only the identification from art with life, as the pop art tried to do, but a kind of a dialogue between art and life, you see? A dialogue, a real dialogue, not an identification.
Yeah, sure. And if you talk, for example, to Anne Hamilton, you're immediately in a life discussion. What is life? What is a sign, maybe?
What's a sign?
What is happening, for example, if you're thinking, if you have love problems, and all of a sudden there's coming a little sentence up in the city.
Yeah.
Is this a sign? And she's saying a very nice thing. This is not a sign. This is recognition. She really worked on a whole sense, and it's what in German you call sinnfällig.
I'm here with Paolo De Grandis in the Taiwan Pavilion. Paolo, can you tell me a little bit about putting this show together and a little bit about yourself and your thoughts as well as a curator doing a show at the very eve of the millennium?
Yeah. Okay, this is the first time Taiwan participate in the Biennale. Taiwan have tried to be in the Biennale for many years, but they couldn't get it because political reasons. The government is not recognized in Italy. In the last years, something has changed, something is more open, and Taiwan have asked me to help them to participate officially in the Biennale, that was done in 1995. First participation was also interesting, but most of the audience was very curious about this country, because, you know, Taiwan, you always think about, you know, made in Taiwan, and that was the spirit of the visitors. This year, I really have to recognize, completely changed. I mean, here, now they recognize a country with 20 million people, and, you know, the audience, they recognize the professionality of this country.
Can you talk a little bit about the artists that you selected?
Yeah, the artists, okay, here we have three completely different artists. The title of this particular show of the Taiwanese Pavilion is Close to Open. That means the close situation of Taiwan in these last 1,000 years. To open, that means the wish, you know, to open in the open air. These three artists are three different situations. Bu Ching Wang, he represents the conceptual art of Taiwan with the installation. He's the old generation. I mean, he was born in the 48. After there is Chen Yen Chen. He represents problem. The Taiwanese art is very strong. That means how they have suffered in the last 1,000 years. And you can see in his image very strong, this cutting his head cut. And it's interesting because he represents the tragedy in a humor way. The third one, Tung Lu Wang, it is very young. He was born in 68. This is, for me and for many other people, is something absolutely new. I mean, something that we never see before. I think this representation is well
done. They're
so
different
and
representing both the ancient and the future.
At the Venice Biennale in the Swiss Pavilion with Roman Signer. I'd like to start by just walking around the exhibition and asking you to tell me a little bit about a number of the works.
Yes. You see here a car, the blue car, with three wheels, and you see the car has a cabin. It's full with water, and inside is a water jet. And you heard a sound. you heard this sound? That's like a fountain, Fontana di Piaggio. That's, you know, Fontana di Trevi, Fontana di Roma, Fontana di Piaggio.
And it is, of course, a Piaggio van, yes. And I saw other work by you in Münster.
Yes.
And this was also with water.
Yes, water is often with water or other forces, natural forces.
And can you tell me what particularly attracts you to these natural forces?
That I begin in the 70s to work, and I go often to the landscape. Also with this car, I work with this car, with my material, I go working in the landscape, not in the sense of land art, no, more in the sense of landscape is my workroom. And I go with this car, and before I go with the train or some other by walking.
Behind us here we have another piece.
This is my bike, and this bike has behind so a plastic band, yellow. I go around this column 100 times. 100? 100, yes.
At the bottom of the column we can see a collection of tape from
100,
where...
100 around. Okay. I was here.
Yes. And no one will steal this bicycle.
Yes. Okay. And now we go inside.
Yes, let's go.
You see here a cabin, like an office, a bureau. I sit there, like the boss. And here comes an explosion with color, and after you see the negative form, was the shadow. That was me, myself, present, absent.
So what we see in this room is a large grid of clay blocks with solid metal blue balls embedded in them.
This piece is in the same time, gleichzeitig. Now we see here balls. Mm. The balls fall down in the same time. You can see that on the film. And these balls are metallic, solid, 3 kilograms. And there are balls, there's no cannonballs, they're balls for sport, on Olympiad sport. And it was hanging on this... ropes, and these ropes were cut by a system of electric firing. You see here the firing machine, like an explosion, only this was not a bang, a big bang, nothing, only you heard like the flames, and the flames burn, cut these ropes.
In your work, there is often an event.
Yes, yes. You know, I can, for example, I can make this work, and the barrel is still here. It's also good. And I like to see how the barrel, how
yes.
long, etc.
I like often that you build up a situation
yes.
where there is expectation.
Yes.
So one could imagine this barrel here.
Yes.
And that is one work.
You know, I made that. When the balls are hanging, that's the installation to the sculptor.
Mm.
And the balls fall down, that's still a sculptor for me.
Of course.
Only something has happened between. A force has manifested in the work, a force. This force, or the gravitation, or an explosion, or the rain, or the wind, or something, natural forces, that's what I like. I will not finish the work, the nature made also
an
a part of the work, that I mean.
Mm. And what I think is very interesting in your work and different from other work is that...
The influence from the natural forces.
And not just the suggestion, because if you had left the balls in the air, there would be this tension and idea.
Yes.
But to have them actually in the ground, it is like this is what happened.
Yes, yes. And when you see the balls in the air, this moment, that is also a sculpture. Only in your head, it's so fast.
Mm.
Only this moment in the air, these balls, that's also a part of this sculpture. Not only the result type.
No, the whole process.
The whole process.
For me, sometimes a feeling of sadness, but a very beautiful feeling of sadness.
Ah, melancholy.
Yeah.
Yes, perhaps. You know, you can say it in my work, it's all the time the past. I made this event, and it's the past, no? That's the melancholic.
Mm. Yes. And I find this combination of something that is very fun with something that is deeper and more melancholic, a very beautiful part of the work.
Yes.
And I was wondering where this might come from.
I don't know. When I stay in this room, when the balls are falling, that was my birthday. And that's something very... Ah, melancholic, you know, it's past. I'm old now. You cannot hold these things.
This moment.
This moment is only here in my head.
I'm here with Esther Ferre. Outside the Spanish Pavilion. Esther, your work, it's very striking, very simple. I'd just like you to talk a little bit about your ideas for it, the conception for the pieces that you have here.
The piece of this Biennale, there is two pieces I choose myself, and one other piece that the commissario want. The two pieces I choose myself was the Dans le cadre de l'art, in the framework of art in English, and Les Trois Grâces. The reason I choose the Dans le cadre de l'art, it's because I make a lot of performance from the 60s to now. And I wanted to present a piece that in a way or one other demand the action. Eh? Don't, this piece is the public who does that. I present a proposition and the public, the visitors, make the piece. And what interested me, two things. First, that the piece is always transformation. And in the other side, that this piece, when the Biennale finish with this version of this piece, because everything is throughout. And in this way, it's like a performance. You do the performance and then nothing rests. You know, and I choose this piece for this reason, to establish one relation with my performance work.
I noticed the way that people were confused when they saw your piece with the frame, the way they moved from one plane to the other. Perhaps you could just describe a little how the lettering, the words work with that, and how you are described.
I never explain my piece. I do, and people can do as they were. Many people told me the people is confused. They don't know what to do, and it's very well. It's absolutely very well. The people traverse the frame immediately. They understand immediately that there is a game, that there is a problem, there is something to understand. And the other people don't understand and go out and came to the other door, and it's you know, in this way, I like Duchamp that said, any interpretation is okay.
Another piece you have in is called The Three Graces.
The Three Graces. Yeah, The Three Graces. Well, at the beginning, I wanted to do something with chairs because I have a lot of installation with chairs. And in my performance, I like chairs. I prefer to be sit than not sit. It's funny, one morning I go to my atelier and immediately I thought, it's like the trois grâces. So I choose this way to put, because I like a lot to put things in equilibrium. And you know, the trois grâces, they are for pleasure of man, they are beautiful, they are runner, and they are bears. Oh. So I decide the pubis triangle is red, because they are bears, they have the period. It's not very often that I put symbolic signification, but in this piece, I admit a little signification. I am feminist, and I wanted to present something for the woman who came to see the exhibition, one kind of complicity.
The other work you have is a photographic piece, an autobiographic photographic piece, also about time.
Yeah, for me, it's very important time. I said always that for me, the performance is the art of time, space, and presence. So normally in my performance work, I work the time like a material, you know.
I'm here in the Hungarian Pavilion with
Attila Csörgő from Budapest.
You have three pieces, am I right?
Yeah, four pieces, but there was an accident with the fourth piece, but I could repair it, and now it's still working. Because I make machines or mobile sculptures, this problem sometimes occurs, and these machines are low-tech, and one of the pieces is a big container, big pot, aluminium pot filled with oil, motor oil, and it is mounted to a rotating disc, and the rotation, the centrifugal force, make the surface of the oil curved. And because the oil in big volume is dark, it can reflect. You can see how the mirror images on the surface of the oil are changing. And the second work is a game of play with two geometrical solids, so-called icosahedron and dodecahedron.
So we're standing now in front of an amazingly elaborate low-tech machine.
This is the dodecahedron phase, and it will be transformed to another solid, which is called icosahedron. And I did it with simple means, with ropes and strings and a very simple mechanism.
Yeah, I just described just now what I'm looking at. A trolley, almost, a framework with a platform, and hung over this platform, which is not very big, are a number of sticks held by string, and these are being lifted by very elaborate mechanisms and weights and cogwheels, and they lift up and down, creating two different forms.
Two of the so-called five platonic solids, and there is only five such a solid which has this regularity. Both solids have the same amount of ages. I could make this transformation. There is a contradiction between the pureness or regularity, high regularity of the solids and very low tech.
Watching this shape change between two of the platonic solids,
yeah.
Staged within, like, it's almost like puppetry, isn't it? How do you come to make this work?
I work a lot with geometry, and I also worked before with solids, but in different way. And I had the idea that I knew that they have the same amount of ages, and then I could transform them into each other. But there are so many possibilities for changing. In the beginning, I made sketches. How could I transform them, in which way, but only with the ages. Then the next phase was when I tried to move them with the strings.
So you constructed this in the space?
Yeah, I reconstructed here.
Right. Let's go and look at other pieces.
No. Exactly at the time of the opening, it was broken. All day long it worked, and before too, and last days, and but exactly at the opening block.
So can you describe what we're looking at?
Yeah, this is a dark space, and use light as material, and hemisphere, this is the title, hemisphere, and there is a rotating heavy disc, and to this disc I mounted a metal rod with two torch bulbs, and this rotates in a 45 angle plane to the floor. This work operates with the collaboration of two rotations, and these two rotations are in different planes. And in this way, you can see a spiralic motion.
And I like that you reveal the low tech, like we're in a darkened room, but the door opens and you can see.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as it becomes dark, it's utterly mysterious.
Yeah, so more dark would be better. But of course, people like when they can see the mechanism too. But the effect is better in a completely dark room.
This is another piece. What is the name of this piece?
It's a solid of revolution glass. And there is a table, and into the table I mounted a fan motor, and I mounted to this fan two long screws. And this is illuminated by a spotlight. The motor automatically is switched on and off, and when it's on, you see a kind of glass.
Yes, an illusion of illusion, a glass.
Or virtual glass. And of course, here the tension is that it is like an everyday situation. Everybody knows that there is a table, and on the table there is a glass.
In both of these pieces, you allow us to understand the mystery. It becomes more magical because we know how simple it is.
Yeah. So I try to avoid using high-tech because I have the feeling that the high-tech solutions make a wall between the viewers and the work.
There were two things that I was discussing with a friend when we looked at this work. One was a kind of alchemy, like a reverse alchemy. You come in, you see the magic, and then it is reduced to its base elements, which is a very beautiful inversion. And the other is a kind of faith.
Of course, the geometry itself has magical aspects. So the two ways are open when people use geometry. One is this magical way, another one is the scientific way. But I don't want to separate them. Both is included, I think, in these pieces.
I'm here at the Polish Pavilion with
Katarzyna Kozyra,
who has an installation called The Men's Bathhouse, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Could you describe this work?
I changed in a man. I got a beard, a penis, hairs on my chest, hair on my chest, and a towel for head, the breast. And I went in a man's bath.
So, did you actually have any operation for this, or no?
Just I don't think it's necessary. I don't want to change. I'm fine.
Could you describe how this work is installed? And it's a video piece, isn't
it? It's a video piece. And the cameras were hidden in a little plastic bag with a hole. And I was just walking with the man in front of this cameras. And I was recorded, and the man as well. And and they didn't recognize that something is wrong with me. I find it funny.
They had no idea they were being filmed.
No. And they didn't recognize me.
So all it takes to be a man is some hair.
Some hair and this thing.
And a penis and a towel.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. This is enough.
What was your motivation to make this work?
I was just curious, and it's always like this, that women are, too often women are shown as the object of virus. Mm-hmm. And I wanted just to do the reverse of the situation, because I thought it's funny. And
it's quite interesting that you changed to a man, mm-hmm. to be the subject of voyeurism yourself.
Yes, yes. I felt a lot of, how do you call it?
People looking.
Yes.
What was the experience in the end?
In the end, I was happy that nothing. nothing fine.
Yeah, what would have happened?
Yes, I was very curious what will happen if my beard falls off, or the penis, or that someone sees that it's not real beard. I was just curious what will be the reaction. And when someone was staring at me, I didn't know if he likes me or maybe he knows something. You know, the experience was crazy because I never knew.
Does this fit into a larger body of work?
Yes, I think so, because I did it in 97. I did the same with women in the women's bath.
Right.
And this is the second part. I think it's not so funny to film men. It's more funny that I changed.
Yes, because I went into the mm-hmm. pavilion not knowing mm-hmm. at all your work or uh-huh. what I was going to see. Uh-huh. And at first I think this is a very beautiful scene uh-huh, of uh-huh. men in the bath. Mm-hmm. And I think of, do you know Tacita Dean's work?
Yes, I know. She made it 1 year later. This I know.
Well, I was remembering her piece, which I saw, uh-huh. and I was thinking this is a beautiful portrait. Uh-huh. And then I see this worrying image of uh-huh. a penis. I couldn't work out if it was being put on or taken off, which uh-huh. was quite comic, but uh-huh, uh-huh. but sort of terrifying yeah. at the same time. Because you first come in to see these uh-huh. screens of, uh-huh. of the bath, and then you get this surprise element. And I was really not sure uh-huh. if you were male or female.
Uh-huh. This is cool.
Because I wasn't clear if the penis was being put on or uh-huh. what. Uh-huh. And I wasn't sure if it was a very androgynous man having hair
yes.
put on.
Yes.
Or if it was a woman changing.
Uh-huh.
What kind of reaction have you been experiencing from people?
Here?
Yeah.
People like it. I like it. I think it's funny. Mm.
And how is it to be part of the Biennale?
It's okay, because many people can see it. It's a great audience. Many, 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 many people, much more than in Poland. Much more international. I think it's important. Mm. But I haven't had time to go and see other things yet. Later I will do it. I've been here 4 years ago, and I'm just for looking. And my opinion was that it's like a market. Yeah. Every country tries to be better. it's so bombastic stuff. Who's the best?
I wondered if you have anything more to add to the concepts and ideas.
The funny thing was that that I didn't know before that there will be an object again, you know?
Really?
Yes, I didn't know it. And I've been an object for some men who very, very, who liked me, really.
As a man?
As a man.
That's amazing.
This was really amazing for me.
So you go...
And
you
I know if I stood up and went out... to a toilet or maybe a shower, some people for them would follow me. So I was very nervous. I thought I will sit and I don't know, and look and be calm, as you said. But it wasn't true, because
so people were very tactile with you.
Yes, yes.
That must have been a surprise.
Yes, it was a surprise, really.
So it's an interesting thing that you go into making this piece of work to reverse a role.
Yes.
You think, Okay, I as a woman, women in general have been looked at, and and you think of Angra and the baths. And So I will reverse this and be a man, and it's the same.
It's the same thing.